Just begin with the Reformation text, or one of the great Reformation texts, Romans 1:17. For therein is the righteousness of God revealed from faith to faith, as it is written, the just shall live by faith. Now, this is a massive subject, needless to say. I came across a quotation by somebody that I doubt anybody else will quote this afternoon or at any time during the conference. It was the Earl of Birkenhead, and he said this: it would be just as impossible to tell the story of the Reformation in one or two or half a dozen lectures, for that matter, as it would be to write the articles of the Church of England on the back of a sixpence. So that is the challenge and the battle we're against here today. But I don't have to talk about all the Reformation in these two sessions, just the romance of the Reformation, as I think it was originally spoken of, but the drama of the Reformation is just as good. But I had to get some kind of a definition of this idea of the romance of the Reformation. It was one of those terms that was often used either side of the First World War. And so I decided I'd look up that book, the Romance of Nonconformity, and its companion, The Romance of Primitive Methodism. And in it, the author, Joseph Ritson, he described this idea of the romance of a subject like this. He says it stands for the wonderful, the extraordinary. It abounds in the marvelous, in adventure, divine in position. It's full of heroic struggles, extraordinary sacrifices, outstanding examples of faith. It illustrates the mighty power and grace of God. And so it goes on. And it's all this kind of thing that it's my responsibility to try and speak of in these two sessions. Now, one of the best stories I think about it all, I may have said before, but I'm going to say it again. There's a wonderful passage in Laterett's History of Christianity, whereby he describes the period about 1500. And he says Christianity was regressing at that time and had become mainly confined to Western Europe. He said, in Asia, North Africa, and so on, it all lost ground. Islam was on the rise, pressing in from the east, pressing upwards from Spain, and so on. And people were looking at the state of Christianity and its corruption, in its error. Everything seemed to be wrong with it that could be wrong with it. And people were saying, it won't last another generation. We've heard that before. Well, then comes the story of the Reformation. And if I might borrow somebody else's quotation just to begin, and this is a quotation referring to the 18th century revival, but it'll do just as well for this. Skevington Wood said, it came without organization and almost without expectation. The impotent church was suddenly invaded by a fresh access of spiritual enablement, both in respect to its source and success. The movement is altogether inexplicable in human terms. It displays its heavenly origin by strong, commanding evidences. Well, that really does sum up the Reformation. Well, the Reformation, we want to emphasize, was there were human instruments in it. Many of them, most of them, were obscure individuals in the first place. Some of those leaders, one would have to say, were extremely clever men. They had genius about them. But other figures in the Reformation were totally unknown. Ordinary people, like the ordinary people that read the New Testaments that Tyndale was producing and smuggling into the country. The ordinary people that I mentioned, so many of them in Fox's famous Book of Martyrs. And the ordinary people, the noble army men and boys, the defiant mass that so strongly objected to Mary, Queen Mary's attempts to return the country to Roman Catholicism. So all that sort of thing. When we look at this story, we see individuals that went outside the camp, separated themselves from the corruptions that were all around them. When we look at this story, we see individuals that began to dig out the old wells, just as Isaac had done in his day. And we see God's hand wonderfully upon certain individuals whose names you well know. Just like in the Old Testament and the New Testament, God laid hold of Abraham, and God laid hold of Moses, and God laid hold of Paul, and so you could go on. Now, this first lecture, I want to focus mainly on Martin Luther, because if there's ever a dramatic or romantic element to the Reformation, it would certainly be the life and experience of this man, Martin Luther. What can we say about him? Well, we could begin like this, as Dobini. I've just been waiting in the bookshop. Very dangerous to be given extra time in there, but I've looked at the splendid examples of reprints of Dobini. Go in there and buy them all, because they're well worth reading. But Dobini said this: the only key to the reformation of the church is supplied by our knowledge of the Reformation wrought, first of all, in the heart of Martin Luther. His search for God, his agonies of soul to find out how can a man be right with God, was used in the most remarkable way in the bringing about of the Reformation. We know there were forerunners of the Reformation, and you could name them all. But we're going to focus, and I think it's right to focus, on that time, which is the 500th anniversary of Luther nailing his 95 theses to the church door, the castle church in Wittenberg. So there it is. Now, we want to emphasize Luther's obscure origins. Indeed, you could take all these Reformation figures, more or less, and talk about their very obscure origins. One historian said this. He says, it could be regarded as a general rule that great men are usually born in small houses. Now, you can think about that. No doubt great women, it applies to them as well. But all these fellows that we're going to speak of had these obscure beginnings. Let me just mention a few just by way of introduction. Luther, as you know, was the son of a copper miner. And we'll say something more about that in a minute. Melanchthon, the great companion of Luther, was the son of an armor maker. And Beza, in his famous Icons, where you can read about all these fellows here, Beza said, the miner's son drew forth the metal, and the armorer's son fashioned it. Well, that puts it together very well. But then Calvin, of course, he was the son, or no, he was the grandson, rather, of a cooper, a maker of barrels. John Knox was the son of a Scottish burgess. Zwingli was born in a tumble-down Swiss cottage high up in a remote region of the Alps. And so you could go on with these men. It is an element of truth that great men are born in small houses. And all of them, perhaps, would have been able to say, as Moses said when God laid hands upon him, who am I that I should go unto Pharaoh and that I should bring forth the children of Israel out of Egypt? They could all say that, or with Paul. For you see, your calling, brethren, not many wise men of the flesh, not many mighty, not many noble a cause, but God hath chosen the foolish things of this world, and so on and so forth. And then a little glimpse at Luther the man. I know you know a lot about him. I know I'm telling you things you know. But he was a great man, we know that. He was a genius. He was a mighty man of God. But he was a man. And I think everybody knows that he experienced some very, very deep bouts of depression, and they were often frequent bouts of depression. We all know about him being a hypochondriac, and he was always thinking he was ill, he was always thinking he was dying, and I was worried about mentioning, but he was often worried about the state of his bowels, and he often writes about it. But he was a man. He was a crude man. That's why I mention that often. Sometimes he was an exasperating man. And sometimes he had grave self-doubts about himself. He sometimes thought, am I doing the right thing? Sometimes he felt he'd said too much. Other times he felt he hadn't said enough. And all these things, he could be crude, yes, and he could be cross at times, and he sometimes could be cruel. And yet, God used this man. So none of us should be discouraged. God does use the foolish and the weak to confound the mighty indeed. So that's Luther the man. Now, where would you expect the Reformation to begin? If you were going to try and start a reformation, of course, no man can start a reformation. That's part of the message I'm trying to bring. But where would you begin? Well, you could have started in some obscure place, which it did, because Luther was born in Eisleben. It's a remote place. It's an out-of-the-way place, and so on. God does that sort of thing. Now, it certainly was not organized, and it certainly did not begin by people going out to get sponsors and to raise a tremendous amount of money and all the rest of it. It's true that various figures in the Reformation, Luther included, did have the help of very influential people as their work progressed. We know that Luther was protected and helped by an unlikely individual, really, and we'll say something more of this in a minute. But Frederick the Wise, the Elector of Saxony, often got Luther out of great trouble. And we could go back to Wycliffe and talk of John of Gaunt, and we could go back to Cranmer and talk about Edward VI. They did have these. And the Lord does cause princes sometimes to be the nursing fathers and mothers of the church. But apart from that, there was nothing really of the help of or organization of man in these things. We know there were political intrigues that ran alongside the Reformation, but you know the devil is always at work when God is at work, and the Reformation continued in spite of them. Now, humble beginnings. We could say, just as we begin that thought, Luther was a German. Well, you say, everybody knows that. But it's kind of significant, really, that he was a German. You could ask the question, well, the Reformation began in an out-of-the-way place. And then you say, well, why did it begin in Germany, of all places? And then you have to come up with answers like this. You could say this. It's definitely the case. The Germans then were a very pious people. They were piously wrong, but they were pious. They were seekers after God, you may say. There was a groundswell of a movement of the Spirit in the souls of that people. They were seekers after God. They had a desire for something better, something more satisfying, something more real than that which the Roman Catholic Church, the medieval Roman Catholic Church in all its corruptness, was offering them. So there was that. You could find that same movement and desire when in the next lecture we say something more about the British or English Reformation. There was also in Germany, as in many other parts, but particularly there, a true realization of the materialistic nature that the church had sunk into, really. The corruptions amongst the priests and the prelates and those who were supposed to be in charge. And the third reason why you could say it developed in Germany, and all this, of course, is under the umbrella of the sovereignty of God, but it developed in Germany because of the political situation of the place. You know, it was all divided up into these various little states or principalities. They each had their elector or their prince, and they were often always arguing with one another, and there was no united voice. And so all that, in the amazing providence of God, formed a fertile field for the Reformation to begin with. Now, Luther himself, this is what he said of himself: "I am the son of a peasant. My grandfather, my great-grandfather rather, grandfather and father were all peasants. They were all peasants. I might have become an overseer, a bailiff, or some other village official, one servant amongst others with authority over the rest. But no, there he was. His father was a miner, and it would have seemed he would be destined to be a miner in his father's footsteps. But his father was very ambitious, you know." It starts off, I mustn't go on here because I'll try and discipline myself. But his father began as a woodcutter, and then his wife had to carry all the woodcut wood back to the village. They were working the Protestant work ethic before Protestantism, the name had ever come about. But they were very, very hardworking, and he had an ambition for his son, and so the money that they made, and I won't go into how they made it anymore, but they did. And they paid for Luther's education. But Luther's, he's unheard of. He will be educated, we'll see in a minute. Elton, a very scholarly fellow, you know, the Cambridge, New Cambridge histories, he records the first mention in history that's written down anywhere of Martin Luther. First record on the pages of history of Martin Luther. And it's in Latin, "Quidam nomine Martin Luther." It simply means a man named Martin Luther. He's writing to what, from one official to another. And it's as if he's saying, "I'm telling you about this man, this Martin Luther, they call him, this obscure, unheard of nobody. But he might cause us a bit of trouble if we don't keep an eye on him." It's that sort of way that he's mentioned. Well, there it was. Nobody saw this cloud as small as a man's hand that was rising up there in that remote part of eastern Germany. We know also, jumping the gun a bit, he eventually becomes a lecturer at Wittenberg University. But it was said of that place, Wittenberg, you know, small city town, it said, "Wittenberg, a little town perched on the edge of beyond." The edge of beyond, that's where he began his great work and so on. Right out of the run of things, an obscure corner of the world. And you know this also, though Luther walked many miles in the course of his life. He walked all the way to Rome on one occasion, 1,000 miles. And he walked more or less to all those various diets and conferences where he had to answer for himself and so on. But the point was this: apart from his trip to Rome, he may have gone there twice, he never left Germany. He was based more or less for the whole of his life there in the back or the edge of beyond. In Wittenberg and the surrounding areas. So there it was. Somebody said the world came to him. But there it was. He began in great obscurity. Now, I said he was a genius. There's no doubt that he was a genius who God took hold of. But, you know, some geniuses, they're not very good at organizing things. You know, they can be in the clouds. Now, you couldn't say Luther was altogether in the clouds, because at one time he was the vicar over, I think, 12 monasteries. But, you know, if you want to know what a man's like, ask his wife. And we could look to Katie von Bora, Luther's wife. Now, when they first came together in marriage, you know, he was older than her, Luther was 100 guilders in debt. That was the first problem she had to sort out. He couldn't organize his everyday affairs, really. He was in debt. She asked him how this had come about, and he said, well, you've only got to look at the human hand, you know. It's so made that the money just goes through these gaps. You know, it was quite simple how I became in debt. And she had to sort out that. She realized he hadn't made his bed for a year. Well, his bed was only straw anyway, but I won't describe what the straw was like because it'll put you off your teeth. But he couldn't organize even changing the bedclothes if they had bedclothes. And all this sort of thing, I won't go into any more, but I could tell you lots of things about his disorderly life. He wasn't a man like Calvin in that sense. Equally as clever as Calvin, equally spiritual and deep and so on. But Calvin has this precision of mind. We know that his, going back to Luther, we know that his father wanted him to be a lawyer. Well, I think that would have been a disaster, really. He could certainly argue his case, but he didn't have that orderliness of mind. So we say all those things about him. I should just say something about his schooling. The remarkable providence of God in the school that he attended. Well, he attended several schools because, remember, his father was ambitious. He was sent to a school in Eisenach, and they had a remarkable sort of, I suppose, futuristic, perhaps, certainly unusual teaching method. It was this. They didn't give the children anything to eat. It was a boarding school. And they had to go and sing for their supper, you know, outside in the street. And Luther was very musical, so he could sing all right. He could have been a great musician, some people say. Nobody opens the door to him, though. He sung his heart out. Nobody came. He stands outside a big house, and he sings this. Foxes to their holes have gone, every bird into its nest. But I wander here alone, and for me there is no rest. And the door flung open, and it was a very nice lady, Ursula Cotter. He was one of the burghers of the town. But I tell you this, her husband, that was in the providence of God, because Luther has come from this rough, this ready, this somewhat uncouth background, and he's going to have to talk with princes, and prelates. He's going to have to, you know, deal with all that, people of that status. That's where he learnt it. Every detail of his life was under the providence of God. Now I've got to very quickly go through all the events from his going to university to all these various diets or tribunals that he had to face. And what I want you to notice in this, because I go through it at record speed, I apologize to the good folk down here, but it's the pressure. If you think you're pressurized, this man had given himself wholly to God. And all the time, you know, when you have something worrying you and something you know you've got to deal with, and this is there lurking on the horizon and it's going to come to you and you've somehow got to deal with that. You know what that's like? Well, he has this for several years. Notice the dates as he goes through all this. But let me quickly say, eventually he gets to university, the University of Erfurt, which was modern and not that long set up. But it was a very good university, and there he had to study the works of the schoolmen, the scholastics of the Middle Ages, William of Ockham and Thomas Aquinas and Gabriel Bile and all those men. But that was in the providence of God, because he had to know what they taught and where they were wrong. Luther's only 18 years of age. It's in the university library of Erfurt. He first sees a copy of the Bible. Can you believe that? First sees a copy of the Bible. You can imagine his eye going on it. You know, if you were Cecil B. DeMille and you were making a film about Luther, how would you portray that scene? Well, you can imagine that. Wiley, in his famous History of Protestantism, likens Luther's discovery of the Bible there in the university library to Columbus gazing on the plains and mountains of the New World, when the mists of ocean opened and unveiled it to him. It's as if his eyes were opened to something he'd never dreamt of, a wonderful treasure. You can imagine him almost trembling with joy and anticipation and awe that he was holding the word of God in his hands. it had, as you can see, not just a tremendous effect upon him, but the whole history of the world. When Luther took that Bible off the shelf there in the University of Wittenberg, Erfurt, I should say, where it had perhaps never been looked at for a long time. Well, there it is. At this time, Luther falls seriously ill and various things happen to him. He's really seriously troubled about his soul. You know this. It culminates in his return to the university after going home through the forest, the Thuringian forest, where the thunderstorm and so on. And he promises he'll become a monk. I won't go into that because you know all about it. But he does keep his promise. He doesn't move towns. There's a monastery in Erfurt, and that's where he goes, to the monastery of Erfurt. Now that would have crushed him. It just shows that these places are not conducive, really, to spiritual life. Perhaps some can survive it. But Luther would have been crushed and unheard of if he had remained in the monastery. But God raised up that man, John Staupitz, a remarkable man that we could say a lot of. He recognized the agonies of Luther's soul. And there's Luther tormenting himself, often for hours and hours, and he's seeking after God. And Staupitz gives him good advice. Instead of torturing yourself on account of your sins, throw yourself into the Redeemer's arms. Trust in him, in the righteousness of his life, in the atonement of his death. It's amazing that he could say that. I mean, we could talk about that for ages, what he knew and what he didn't. But what he actually said, you couldn't argue with it, could you? And Staupitz also knew that Luther needed something to do. You know, we've been talking about the priesthood of all believers. Staupitz may have had some understanding of that. He could see that Luther needed something to channel his energies into. And he gave him a job lecturing in Wittenberg University that we mentioned a few moments ago. Then, you know about his journey to Rome. The Augustinian order that he belonged to sent him to Rome on an errand. He was delighted to go there. He walked 1,000 miles, as I said. This was it, Holy Rome at last. Oh, he longed to see the eternal city, and when he catches sight of it, he falls down on his knees and thanks God and praises God that he's going there. Little did he know, Rome was the Las Vegas of that age. And he's shocked beyond all measure at what he sees in that place. But nevertheless, he tries to follow up all the various Roman Catholic rituals and things that he felt he ought to do. And the famous stairs, Pilate's staircase, which they taught had come miraculously flying through the air from Jerusalem and landed in Rome, and go up there and say the Paternoster on every step, which he did. And Dobina, I think it is, that says, and when he got to the top, he thought to himself, what have I done? What folly? What superstition? And Dobina says it came into his mind again, as it had already done before, the just shall live by faith, the righteousness of God. The whole question of when Luther was converted is controverted by the various historians. Some say it was before or in, say, 1515, and some say 1519. I'm not going to argue with anybody, but the thing is, was he converted before he nailed the 95 Theses or after? Well, I think personally it was before, but I won't fall out with anybody who thinks it was other. But it was. Luther called it his terma lebnis, his tower experience in the monastery tower alone with the epistle to the Romans. He was agonized by the concept of the righteousness of God, as you know. And he thought the righteousness of God was something we had to achieve. He couldn't do it. He was in agonies. He was a lost man. He said he even hated God for setting such standard that nobody could ever aspire to. Till he realized the righteousness of God was that which God gave to us through the mercies of Christ, the gift of God, the righteousness of God, which is by faith, faith alone. Well, anyway, he's a converted man. He receives his doctorates in theology, yes, but in biblical studies. That was unusual for that time. That's another remarkable providence, that they should set this man to study the Bible and pay him for it. And he gives himself to it. Some of the writers say he lectured on Scripture, first of all Psalms and Romans, every afternoon at 1 o'clock. Some of the others say he only did it twice a week, but I like the idea of him every week. It's said that in the course of his life, 16,000 students passed through his lectures there. He never traveled far, but God sent people to where he was, and who would know what an influence came out of that. He was the monk that changed the world. Then they made him the town preacher in Wittenberg Church, which, if you can imagine these days, we might call it a mizzen hut. It really was the town church, but it was some rough-built wooden place, drafty and dilapidated. But there he preached his first sermons. So if you're in some place like that, don't be discouraged, because God does wonderful things beyond our imagining. James Atkinson, in his book on Luther, said, if you looked at a map of Europe in 1517, peopled by men of distinction such as Erasmus, Dean Collett, Thomas More, Michelangelo, Leonardo da Vinci, Raphael, Titian, Henry VIII, Francis I, Charles V, etc., etc., all the great cultural, intellectual, political giants of the age. You may have looked at all those names, but Martin Luther wouldn't have been amongst them. Nobody would have conceived that the greatest figure of the age would have come from there, Wittenberg and so on. So think of all that. Well, Luther receives his doctorate, and there he is. He's all set up, really, to do his life's work. The story of the 95 Theses, I can't really say much about. You know the story. That's remarkable. Luther is upset about the selling of these indulgences and so on, and people are coming to him saying they want to confess. He wants them to hear their confession, and then they tell him of all their sins, and then he tells them what to do, and then they say, it's all right, we've got this. We've got these indulgences. We don't have to do anything. And he's shocked. Anyway, there was to be a big sale of indulgences the next day. This is October the 31st, 1517. It's going to be All Saints' Day the next day, and there's going to be this big event there in Wittenberg. It wasn't Tetzel that was selling the indulgences on that occasion. He wasn't allowed into that province, so I won't go into that. But it was the elector himself, Frederick the Wise, who was behind it. Do you know he had 17,000 relics in that church? If I told you what they were, some of them, you again would be shocked. The strange thing was, here is a man, Frederick the Wise, who collected 17,000 relics, and yet he's the man whom God uses in the end to defend and to support and protects in every way Martin Luther. Again, it's all an amazing story. Well, the theses have been nailed up and Luther's in trouble. Dr. Johannes Eck starts to criticize him, write papers about him, and try and link him up with John Huss. John Huss objected to the selling of indulgences 100 years before. And when you think that he was saying, Martin Luther, you're doing the same things as John Huss, remember, digging out the old wells, well, he was doing that, but he was likening him to John Huss so that he would end up the same way as John Huss on the stake. So he had all that going on. They have the Heidelberg Disputation, 270 miles, he walked to that, by the way, on foot. again, these were tremendously worrying, anxious things. He's accused of spreading bohemian poison. And the penalty for that really would have been death itself. Luther, though, remarkably makes use of all these various occasions, because the more they bring him before their councils and so on, the more people have heard of him. We might just say these councils go on. There is the council then of Augsburg. That's in 1518. This one has just been just a few months before. I can't tell you anything about it because I haven't got time. But all I would say is this council, Heidelberg, Augsburg, in a way they were the most dangerous ones for Luther, far more dangerous than when he comes to the Diet of Worms, because in these early councils, he's unknown. He's unknown. And he could have easily been just eliminated, and nobody would have known anything about it. So it was very dangerous. Why did he get away with it, as it were? Because of the political situation. No one power could have the supreme authority to arrest him. 1519, January, he has to go to Altenburg, 62 miles again distance. He has to appear before a man called Miltitz, just one man. You know, I'm not going to name any names. Keep in mind, there are some politicians, and you would say, I wouldn't trust them as far as I could throw them. Well, maybe you don't say that, but there are some individuals who you may imagine, and they're very subtle and very clever, and they can trip you up, and they can smooth talk you and all that sort of thing. Well, this man, Miltitz, was like that. And the idea was he'd come and smooth talk Luther and get him to agree to keep quiet. And if he agreed, they'd keep quiet. That was the deal. And Luther did say he would keep quiet, but this man Miltz, he's got his pockets stuffed full of papers whereby at the least thing he could have arrested Luther and so on. But Luther is brought through all that. It's quite remarkable, really. It goes on to the Leipzig disputation, July 1519. Luther arrives in a cattle truck on that occasion with 200 students because he knows he's going into the mouth of the lion. And there he has to stand before Karlstadt and so on. What could I tell you about that ever so much? But again, Karlstadt prevaricates, really, in it. He is slow to act, although Luther is now a doomed man. But Luther slips out of Leipzig in the dead of night, helped by his friends. The amusing thing is he left his breeches behind, apparently, such was the haste. But he gets away with it. And then there's a papal bull threatening to, well, the papal bull is excommunication, it's the end, and Luther burns it. And so it goes on. And then there's the Diet of Worms, April 1521, when before the emperor, the Holy Roman Emperor, Charles V, and the prelates of the church and all the officials, he goes into the very lion's den itself. There's a pile of books there. Apparently, it's not like this on the pictures, but apparently only the emperor sat. Everybody else had to stand up. And remember, the emperor is emperor over Spain and Holland and Germany and other minor states in Europe. He's a tremendously powerful figure. The pile of books is on the table, and another Johannes Eck, same name but a different man, he says to Luther, are these books yours? Yes. Do you retract anything that you have said? What would you like to withdraw from what you have written? Luther says, I have to think about it, because he says, many of the things I've said nobody could dispute. And they give him a day to say what he will retract. It was very kind of them. But the next day he comes and he has to answer. They feel they've got him. And he said, unless I am convinced by the testimony of scriptures or by clear reason, for I do not trust in either the Pope or in councils alone, since it is well known that they have often erred and contradicted themselves, I am bound by the scriptures. I quote it, and my conscience is captive to the word of God. And I cannot and I will not retract anything, since it is neither safe nor right to go against conscience. Here I stand. I can do nothing else. God be with me. Amen. That was it. They'd promised him safe passage, so they had to give it him. And they let him go, although the emperor said he wished he'd have sent Luther to the stake there and then. And on the way out, you know that his good friend Frederick the Wise sent a posse of men to capture him and carry him away to the Wartburg Castle and hide him. And nobody knew where he was for a long time. And there in the Wartburg, he began to translate from the original New Testament, then the Old Testament later. He was a doomed man. He was condemned. If they'd have known where he was, that would have been it. But he's there. And then after some long time, he comes out, goes back home, and nobody touches him. Now I could spend hours saying about the remarkable events that followed on from this. Some of them terrible, some of them tragic, the peasants' revolts and all manner of ills that Luther despised and agonized over. He was a tortured man. The cost of what he accomplished was enormous. But God mightily, wonderfully, extraordinarily honored him and upheld him and delivered him. And much that we enjoy today is a result of that great man, Martin Luther, and God's grace in his life. I'd better stop.